Well, we have continued for a considerable time in the series on regeneration and renewal, so much so that some are beginning to wonder, when will this series ever end? And now that I preach somewhat less frequently than before, it would seem that this series is virtually never going to end. Well, every time, and I must tell you this, every time I intend to end the series, the Lord shows me something more that I have to say. So that I also begin to wonder when it will end. It's truly wonderful how the Lord continues to lead in this subject. And as a result of this, I will continue now in this series on regeneration and renewal. On the theme, today's theme will be in His image. The subject to being in His image. Now, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, both in the old creation and in the new creation, we learn that we were created in God's image. And it is this that we need to understand more fully. What does it mean that both in the old creation and in the new creation, God created us in His image? That we are created even in the new creation in His image is seen, for example, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 24. The new man, not the new nature, as the RSV has translated it quite incorrectly. Anthropos, the usual word for man. The new man created in the image of God, as Ephesians 4:24 reads. What then does it mean that we are created in His image? More precisely, what is the reason that God created you and created me in His image? What is the reason for this? What did God have in mind when He created man in His image? Now, of course, my question has already presupposed something. And it has presupposed something that we shall come to in a moment. Because according to Protestant theology, you and I are no longer in God's image. In which case, of course, there was only one man who ever was in God's image, namely Adam. And then after the fall, the image was wiped out, blurred, marred, whichever you like to call it. I'm going to show you that this teaching which is in fact very fundamental to Protestant theology, I have to tell you truthfully, is unscriptural, as I shall demonstrate to you today. And I shall also explain why Protestant theology holds such a view, and I will let you examine the scriptural evidence. Now, I find it distressing to myself, and I have to share this with you, that so many times when I have to expound the scripture, I have to clear away so much of the obstacles that theology was supposed not to build. Theology was supposed to build for us a road of doctrine. Instead, it built for us hedges and walls. Or putting it in another figure of speech, it seems to us that many theologians, like the blind, have been leading the rest of the blind into the ditch. Now, I ask forgiveness if these remarks sound rather harsh, but I am distressed. Indeed, I am almost angry that those who were meant to teach us have led us into the ditches instead of along the highways, even if it be a narrow highway, the way of life. Now we are going to look at evidence, but I say again that it disturbs me that time and again when I want to expound some wonderful teaching in the scripture, I find I have to clear away theological obstacles first before I can even get onto the subject. And I assure you that I take no delight in fighting this kind of battles. But the truth has to be stated. And I let every child of God discern for himself whether it be the truth or not. Adam was created in the image of God. And this we find in Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Very familiar to most of us, but let me read it to you in any case. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Then God said, after He had created all these other creatures, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the land of the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now, here we find it stated repeatedly that man, here reference to Adam has not yet begun, but man was created in God's image. Now, according to Protestant theology, the Imago Dei, the image of God in man, was either marred or destroyed. Karl Barth, the spokesman for neo-orthodoxy of Protestant theology, the famous Karl Barth, who died not so long ago, professor at Basel in Switzerland, writer of the whole range, volume after volume of so-called of dogmatics. He sums up the Protestant theology, the position of Protestant theology, in the words that man's, in the idea that man's, since the fall of man, God's image in man was totally, completely destroyed. Well, Emil Brunner, another well-known Swiss theologian, however, does not agree with Barth of this position. He thinks Barth is a little too extreme, because he rightly sees that if Barth is correct, then every point of contact between God and man has been destroyed. There is no more point of contact between God and man. There is no more, he uses the term Anknüpfungspunkt in German, I guess can only be translated as a point of contact, because Brunner saw that the image of God was the important point of contact between God and man. If that is destroyed, how is man and God able to communicate at all in any sense? Well, however, Brunner himself maintains that the image of God, though not totally destroyed, has become marred, blurred. Of course, this is a rather vague position to take, because it leaves open the question, how marred is marred? How blurred is blurred? How blurred did it get? Because if you make it blurred enough, I mean, if it is, say, 98% blurred, then you might just as well use Karl Barth's position and say that it's been destroyed. Supposing there is a beautiful picture, and somebody splashes ink all over it, or paint all over it, and most of it has been covered up. I mean, would you say it's blurred, or would you say it's destroyed? I think you can just as well say it's destroyed, even if some part of the canvas is still left showing. So, you see, Brunner's position is also quite unsatisfactory, because it leaves quite doubtful the question, is it, to what extent it is blurred? What is left of that image? If there is something left of it, when I look at you and when you look at me, is it possible to discern anything of that image? And if so, how do I know that I am looking at the image of God or not? Because I don't know whether it's blurred or not blurred, or to what extent it is blurred, or is it blurred in different people to different extents? Well, we see that this whole thing is merely confusing the issue and leaving the matter in the dark. Similarly, A.A. Jones, New Bible Dictionary, under the article Image, says this: because of the sin of Adam, this image is blurred and is therefore not clearly seen in Adam's sons. There we are back to this blurred business again, and then we still have the question, how much blurred is blurred? But I won't even bother to waste time with this, because all you have to do is look at Scripture to see whether there is any truth in these dogmatic positions whatsoever. In other words, when you look at Scripture, I ask only for evidence as to where in Scripture, I ask you, where in Scripture does it say that the image of God was blurred, marred, destroyed, whatever you like? Where? Well, A.A. Jones, New Bible Dictionary, cites Genesis 5:3. Well, let's look at Genesis 5:3. What does Genesis 5:3 say? That is, and by the way, the only verse we can produce. And this is what we read. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. Well, so what's wrong with it? Well, in order to arrive at his conclusion, of course, you have to do a piece of in-reading, what in scriptural interpretation is called eisegesis. That is, you put something into the text or assume it says something that hasn't been said. Well, all I can see here is that Adam had a son, and the son was in his image. Very good. So what's the problem? Well, you see, he says, well, Adam had already sinned, and therefore the son was in his image. Oh, really? Well, let's read a bit further back. Verse 1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. This is after the fall. It's still being repeated now. Male and female, he created them. Has anything changed? Are there no more male and female either? Or has that not been affected? I wonder which part and how we decided what has been affected. But anyway, male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them man when they were created. Has his name changed? He is still called man, presumably, and he is still male and female. All that part, we agree, has not changed. Then what has changed? And it is after this introduction that it goes on to say, and Adam had a son, and he was in his own image. It has just been said that Adam was in God's image. Now let me ask you, what would Moses have written had he had to change the word? Could he have written like this? When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in God's likeness, after God's image? Is not the sentence really saying that he is transmitting the likeness which he himself had to his son? And it has just been said that he was created in God's image, and that image which is now in himself is transmitted to his son. Now you have to read a lot into this verse, which theologians unfortunately are exceedingly good at. Read a lot into that verse. In other words, we have to read our own presupposition and dogma into this verse to bring out of it the fact or the supposition that Seth was marked. But if Adam has not been said to have been marked, how does it happen that Seth is marked? Because nowhere before that was it said. Never was it said. Notice, we need a specific statement somewhere which says Adam lost the image of God, or that his image was lost. We must not assume it. That is the error of theology, to assume something that was not said. Now, the truth of the matter is that contrary to saying that the image of God was lost after the fall, we find it repeated both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament after the fall, that man is, not was, is in God's image. Let me give you an example. A few chapters on, Genesis chapter 9, verse 6. What do we read here? Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Now, if anyone kills, he will be killed. That is the reason. Why? The reason is now given. For God made man in his own image. Man is in God's image. That is why if you kill a man, you must die for it. That is the reason. Now, it doesn't take a great logician to see that if man is no more in God's image, then the logic of this statement is destroyed. There is no reason not to shed blood. Because the only reason that shedding blood is a crime is because man is in God's image. Isn't that what the verse is clearly saying? Therefore, because man is in God's image, to raise your hand against a man is to raise your hand against God. And to kill a man is to destroy God's image. It is, in other words, an assault upon God himself. It is punishable by death. But you can see immediately that if man is no more in God's image,
that the whole basis of this verse is destroyed. If man is no more than an ordinary animal, nowhere in scripture it says you cannot kill an animal. The reason why man cannot be killed is already clearly given. Now, we see in fact that not only is this so in the Old Testament, the same is true in the New Testament. Man is still seen to be in God's image in more than one place. Let us see one place in James chapter 3 verse 9. That I may make sure that you are rooted in the scriptures and not in any suggestions of my own. James chapter 3 verse 9 reads like this. It is speaking about the tongue. And this is what James says. With the tongue we bless the Lord and Father, and with the tongue we curse men, who are made in the likeness of God. Do you see the significance of the statement? In the Old Testament it says if you kill the man, you will die for that. You have raised your hand against the image of God. But James is applying the same principle. If you try to kill a man with your tongue, you curse him. You speak evil about him. You destroy his reputation. You destroy his name. You are guilty of murder. In much the same way as in the Old Testament. You have cursed the likeness of God because man is in the likeness of God. If man were no longer in the likeness of God, this same sentence is meaningless because the only person who ever was in the likeness of God would have been Adam, no one else. And if the only person we could not curse would have been Adam, and the only person we couldn't kill would have been Adam, and we can't kill him anyway, he isn't around. You see that again and again, man is seen to be in the image of God. Even now, he is in the image of God. That is why the Ten Commandments embodies this very thing. Any person who kills will himself be put to death. Thou shalt not kill. Man is in the image of God. He still is. And that is why the Ten Commandments remain valid. In this very thing, it shows the reason why we may not kill. It is not arbitrary. It is because in so doing, whether you kill with your hand or with your mouth, with your tongue, when you slander a person, when you speak evil of a person, remember this. You are speaking against the image of God. That gives new depth to the Sermon on the Mount. Judge not that you be not judged. Condemn not that you don't be condemned. That gives a new significance to this. Man is in God's image. Now that's very important for us to think. Very important for us to see. So where do our theologians get the idea? Exactly where do they get the idea that the image of God in man was destroyed? I can't find it in scripture. If you can find it, be so kind as to show it to me. But to base a dogmatic theology on Genesis chapter 5 verse 3, which says that Seth was in the image of Adam, is utterly ridiculous. I'm sorry to say, it makes me angry that any responsible theologian can base a doctrine on such a text as that is utterly absurd. I almost wonder if this is willful blindness and trying to lead everyone into the ditch. But of course our friend Jones and the others can produce no other text from scripture to show this. Nowhere does it say the image of God in man was destroyed. We live in days, brothers and sisters, where we require the utmost discernment to be able to survive, because I don't know where our theologians are going and whether they have become utterly blind for the most part. And again, I beg your forgiveness for speaking so harshly, but I am concerned about the sheep of the flock, and I shall be hard on any shepherds who lead the sheep into the mouth of wolves, or into ditches, or into dangerous places. I shall not spare those shepherds, neither will God, I can assure you, to bring this kind of doctrine out of scripture. And so I warn you of the pitfalls of what is called dogmatic or systematic theology. Very dangerous indeed, because they are systematized by people whose grasp of scripture is often exceedingly poor. Dogmatic theologians have not been noted as good exegetes at any time, I have to tell you that. And so the scriptural teaching itself has been ignored and disregarded. Now why? Why do the dogmatic theologians produce this kind of doctrine? Particularly the Protestant theologians. The reason is quite easy to understand. Here I have to be particularly hard on Protestant theologians. It is the over-anxiety, I stress over-anxiety of Protestant theology to safeguard the doctrine of sola gratia. Sola gratia means it's by grace alone. The doctrine that we are saved by grace alone. We are so anxious to protect this doctrine that we want to reduce mankind to imbeciles. We want to reduce them to degenerates. We want to reduce them all to criminals. Because then only it is all by grace alone. Now the intention may be exceedingly good. The logic is exceedingly stupid. Well, let us consider this for a moment. We are nullifying the grace of God in order to establish the grace of God. What do we mean? That we are created in God's image at all, is that not the expression of His grace? Did we create ourselves in God's image? It is He, by His own grace, by His sovereign wisdom and power, He chose to create us in His image. If that is not grace, then what is grace? By any definition of grace, Protestant or Catholic or any other kind, that is grace. Now we are going to say, we are going to destroy all this grace by our dogmatic theology in order to establish grace alone. What are we doing? Is this not utter foolishness? Why must human beings be reduced to imbeciles, spiritual degenerates, before we can talk about grace alone? Why? I have not seen the logic of that at all, whatsoever. The fact that man is in the image of God, does it mean that he can save himself? We here must have jumped many stages of thinking or logic somewhere along the line that we have missed. The truth is that we have not understood the scriptural doctrine of the imago Dei at all, of the doctrine of the image of God at all. The truth is that our being in the image of God does not automatically save us. Not in the least. The fact that the scriptural doctrine of the image of God, as we shall see further on, is that God has merely given us, in giving us His image, the potential of becoming fully like Him. Whether we reach that potential is another matter. But we can never reach that potential except by God's grace alone. This is not difficult for any of us who have been born again to understand. The fact that you and I are born again means that we have the image of God now, and nobody can take that truth away from us. Not even these Protestant theologians can. The fact that you and I now are created in the new creation in the image of God, does it mean that from now on, because we are created in the image of God, we can save ourselves? Of course not. It means, in fact, quite the reverse. It means that every moment since regeneration, we are utterly, totally dependent on His saving grace. So where is the logic of our Protestant theologians? What are we talking about? Again, I apologize. I apologize again and again, if I may, for being so hard on the theologians. But what I will not apologize for is that our friends are leading the church into the ditches, and this we will not stand for. Now, having cleared, had this unpleasant task of clearing these obstacles, for which again I apologize to have to take time on these matters. But if I don't tell you these things, you will go out and find other people saying, haven't you seen the scripture says that man lost the image of God? Man never lost the image of God, not at least until anyone can demonstrate that to me from scripture. But this raises, of course, the question, what is the image of God that God lost? If they claim that the image of God got lost, then what is the image? What got lost? How can sin destroy this image? Because first you have to assume something about that image before sin can destroy it. So, what after all is this image of God and man? Well, when we come looking at this, we find that there are many suggestions, and I'll take you back to our theologian friends again. And in this time, maybe, hopefully, they're not too far off the mark. But if they are not far off the mark, then clearly they have contradicted themselves. Now, take, for example, the German Old Testament theologian, Ludwig Kühler. He thought that the likeness of God in man consists in the erect stature of man. Now, before you think this is too funny, you think, what is this serious or is this a joke? No, he is very serious. What he means that man, you see, stands upright. Of course, monkeys stand upright too, occasionally. But only occasionally. Man normally stands upright. Sometimes I almost find it embarrassing to talk about theology. But anyway, so man stands upright, which, according to him, symbolizes man's elevation over the animals and his power to rule them. His elevation over the animals. Well, it seems to me that giraffe is an awful lot taller than man. And it seems to me that by that qualification, the giraffe should be ruling over men, because he stands head and shoulder, and I mean literally head and shoulder, above any man. Again, I apologize for being so rude to our theologian friends, but I find it a little bit difficult to refrain from some sense of amusement. Anyway, so he stands upright most of the time. Now, Walter Eichrott, another German theologian, thinks that the likeness is to be placed in the spiritual qualities of man. Now, I find that there we are talking much more something like sense to me. Because after all, the Bible is concerned to speak about spiritual qualities. And the spiritual qualities Eichrott sees is self-consciousness and self-determination. Namely, that man's likeness to God is seen in his personality. Now, clearly, we are coming much closer to the truth of the matter. But if Eichrott is right, that man's likeness to God is seen in his self-consciousness, then how can that image be marred or blurred? If you and I are like God in our personality, in our being self-conscious beings, self, and he uses also the term beings with self-determination, that is, you are able to make decisions, you are able to think and to reason, then how can the image be blurred or marred, whatever, can even less destroyed? Because if it were destroyed, then man must be totally mad by now. And if self-consciousness were destroyed by the fall, then man wouldn't even be a human being. I mean, what is man without self-consciousness? So again, you see, Eichrott himself is a Protestant theologian, and then now you see the Protestant theologians beginning to contradict each other. The early Greek fathers, some of the early Greek fathers, such as Gregory of Nyssa, had similar thoughts. He saw the likeness of God in man in the fact that man has free will. And others saw the likeness in man's capacity to reason. And Augustine, for example, our friend Augustine, he saw the likeness of God in man in this respect, entirely in the intellectual capacities. He sees, for example, that man has memory, intellect, and will. And he sees that as comparable to the Trinity. That memory is comparable, he sees this as comparing to the Father, the intellect to the Son, and the will to the Spirit. So that man is a Trinity of being, rather like God, who is a Trinity of being. But characteristic of Augustine, he has put the whole thing onto the intellectual level, rather than the spiritual level. And why he saw the parallel in memory, intellect, and will, of course, we will see at once, is totally arbitrary. It has no other justification than it just occurred to Augustine that it was a nice idea. But we could just as well have said that man is body, mind, and spirit, and a trinity of body, mind, and spirit, which would make just as much sense as Augustine's suggestion. So the